Trying to stay on top of things and really understand how the world works, especially the economy, it can feel like a constant uphill battle, right? With information coming from like all directions.
Yeah, it really can. Overwhelming sometimes.
So for this deep dive, we're going to try and cut through some of that noise and get to the core of a really important idea. Market failure.
Ah, yes. Market failure.
This is what happens when the normal back and forth of buying and selling, supply and demand, doesn't actually lead to the best results for everyone.
Exactly.
Our sources today, they really dig into why this happens and, well, what can maybe be done about it.
Yeah, the causes and potential fixes.
So our mission is pretty simple, really. We want to get a clear, engaging, and relevant understanding of what market failure is, what causes it, and how governments try to step in. Even if you don't spend your weekends buried in economic reports.
Exactly. Think of it like this. Imagine a perfectly smooth running market. Everyone who wants, say, a loaf of bread can get it at a price that makes sense, right? And the baker isn't wasting any ingredients or energy making it. That's the ideal.
Right, efficient.
Market failure is when we fall short of that ideal. Formally speaking, it's when the free market doesn't allocate resources as efficiently as it could, leading to, well, a less prosperous society overall, a loss of economic welfare.
Okay, so it's like the economic version of things just not quite clicking the way they should. And this inefficiency, it has different angles, right?
That's precisely. Our sources highlight two key ways markets can be inefficient. First, there's allocative inefficiency.
Okay.
This means we're not producing the mix of goods and services that people actually want most. Imagine if, everyone overwhelmingly preferred apples, but for some reason the market kept churning out tons of oranges.
Huh.
That mismatch, that's allocative inefficiency. Resources are being used to make something less desired, and society's overall satisfaction, its welfare, is lower than it could be.
That makes sense. So it's not just about having enough stuff, but having the right stuff, the stuff people actually value.
Yeah.
And the second type.
That's productive inefficiency. This one's about how we make things.
Okay.
Are we using the fewest resources possible, the least labor, the least capital, the least energy to produce a certain amount of goods or services? Market failure can lead to situations where businesses aren't operating as cheaply as they could be.
Why would that happen?
Well, maybe due to a lack of competition, or maybe they're using outdated technology. This ultimately means either higher prices for consumers or just less output overall.
Got it. So market failure means we might not be getting what we really want that's allocative, or we're paying more for it than we maybe should because things aren't being made in the most efficient way that's productive.
Exactly. You've got it.
Okay, so now let's get into the why. What are the main reasons these market failures actually happen? Our sources point to several key factors.
Yeah, and one of the biggest ones is the idea of externalities.
Externalities. Okay.
What's fascinating here is that when someone buys or sells something, a transaction, it can create these knock-on effects, impacts on people who weren't even part of that original deal, third parties.
Right. Externalities, those hidden costs or maybe hidden benefits that spill over onto others. Yep. Can you give us some examples? Make it a bit clearer.
Absolutely. Let's start with negative externalities. These are the external costs. Think about a factory producing widgets.
Okay, widgets.
People buy the widgets. The factory makes a profit. Simple enough. But if that factory is also pumping out pollution into the air, well, that pollution can harm the health of people living nearby. It can damage the environment, crops, buildings.
Right. And the factory isn't paying for that damage usually.
Exactly. These are costs that aren't paid for by the factory or the widget buyer. They're borne by society as a whole. Some studies estimate that air pollution alone costs the global economy billions, maybe trillions, in healthcare expenses and lost productivity each year.
Wow. So the price of that widget on the shelf might look reasonable, but society is actually paying this hidden price.
Yeah.
Health issues, environmental cleanup.
Precisely. Then we have the flip side. Positive externalities. These are external benefits.
Uh-huh.
This is where someone's actions create benefits for others who aren't directly involved or paying. A classic example mentioned in our material is vaccination.
Ah, right. Vaccination.
When you get vaccinated against, say, the flu, you're obviously protecting yourself. That's the private benefit. But you're also making it less likely that the flu will spread to vulnerable people in your community, maybe the elderly, infants, people with weakened immune systems.
Mm.
That's a benefit that extends far beyond just you. It helps the whole community.
So my decision to get a shot has this positive ripple effect, making everyone a little safer.
Yeah.
Externalities, negative and positive, that's one big piece of the puzzle. What else leads to market failure?
Another crucial area involves what economists call merit and demerit goods.
Merit and demerit goods.
And the interesting thing here, often underlying this, is what we call information failure. People don't always have a clear picture, or maybe they misjudge the true long-term costs or benefits of consuming certain things.
So this is where we talk about things that society sort of thinks are either really good for us, maybe even if we don't fully grasp how good, or really bad for us, even if we kind of enjoy them in the moment.
Precisely. Let's take merit goods first. These are things that provide greater social benefits than individuals typically realize or perhaps value when making their own choices. This often leads to them being underconsumed from society's perspective.
Underconsumed. Okay, like what?
Think about education, healthcare, maybe public libraries, museums. While an individual might see the immediate cost, tuition fees, time spent studying, maybe co-pays for doctor visits, they might underestimate the long-term benefits.
How so?
Well, the benefits for their own future career prospects, their long-term health, and also the benefits for society as a whole, like having a more informed, skilled, and productive population. Because these wider benefits aren't fully factored into individual decisions, people tend to consume less of these goods than would be ideal for society.
Right. Like, I might skip that extra training course thinking, yeah, it will make a huge difference. But collectively, if lots of people get more training, it boosts the whole economy in ways we might not directly connect to my single choice.
Exactly. Then on the flip side, we have demerit goods.
Okay, bad stuff.
Well, things generally considered harmful, both to the individual consuming them and often to society more broadly, but they tend to be overconsumed.
Overconsumed. Examples.
The usual suspects. Alcohol, tobacco, maybe junk food, gambling. In these cases, people might focus on the immediate pleasure, the satisfaction, the thrill, without fully considering or perhaps discounting too heavily the long-term health consequences, the risk of addiction, or the societal costs.
Like healthcare costs for smoking-related illnesses, or accidents related to drunk driving.
Exactly. That gap in understanding, or the way we weigh present pleasure against future harm, that information failure contributes to the market, leading to a higher level of consumption than is socially optimal.
So with demerit goods, the immediate gratification kind of overshadows the bigger picture of harm. And that's where the market goes wrong.
Okay, so information failure is a big player here for both merit and demerit goods. What's the next cause?
Moving on, another really significant cause is related to public goods and this concept called the free rider problem.
Public goods,
right?
These are things like national defense, maybe clean air, street lighting, stuff that once it's there, everyone benefits from.
Exactly. The key defining characteristics are twofold. First, they are non-excludable.
Non-excludable, meaning?
Meaning it's difficult or basically impossible to prevent people from using the good or service, even if they don't pay for it. Think about streetlights on a public road. You can't really stop someone from benefiting from the light as they walk or drive past. Okay, yeah, makes sense. And the second characteristic.
They are non-rivalrous. This means one person's use or consumption of the good doesn't reduce the amount available for others. My enjoying the streetlight doesn't make it any dimmer for you.
Got it. National defense is another good example, right? My being protected doesn't diminish your protection.
Precisely. Now, combine those two features, non-excludable and non-rivalrous. Think about it from a private company's perspective.
Okay, I see the challenge brewing here. If everyone can benefit without paying, why would anyone voluntarily pay for it?
That's the absolute core of the free rider problem. Because people can essentially get a free ride, enjoy the benefits of the public good without contributing to its cost. There's very little, if any, incentive for private companies to produce these goods.
They can't make a profit.
Exactly. If they tried, say, setting up a lighthouse and charging ships, ships could just benefit from the light without paying. The company would likely go bankrupt. This leads to public goods being underprovided, or maybe not provided at all, by the free market mechanism.
So that's why we typically see governments stepping in to fund things like national defense, or build roads and bridges, or maintain parks. The market just isn't set up to handle these kinds of goods effectively on its own.
Precisely. The free rider problem necessitates some form of collective action, usually through the government using tax revenue.
Okay. Makes sense. What's next on the list of market failures?
Another important factor in the market failure story is monopoly power.
Monopoly, right. That's when a single company has pretty much complete control over the market for a particular product or service.
Exactly. Or at least significant market dominance. When one firm dominates, the normal competitive forces, the pressures that usually drive prices down towards cost and encourage innovation, are weakened, or maybe even completely absent.
So what problems does that cause?
Well, a monopolist, lacking significant competition, can often charge higher prices than would exist in a competitive market. They can also restrict the amount of product available to keep prices high and offer fewer choices to consumers.
Because where else are consumers going to go?
Exactly. Our sources might point to examples like, maybe historically, single companies controlling essential resources like diamonds, or maybe local utility companies like water or electricity providers, which often operate as natural monopolies.
Natural monopolies.
Yeah, situations where it's most efficient for only one firm to operate, like laying down one set of water pipes. But even then, their power needs managing.
And without that pressure from competitors, there's also less reason for them to, like, come up with new and better products or find more efficient ways of doing things.
Right.
They can get complacent.
Absolutely. That lack of competitive pressure can really stifle innovation and lead to productive inefficiency over time. That's a key reason why governments often implement antitrust laws.
Right. To prevent monopolies from forming in the first place, or sometimes to break up existing large companies if they're deemed to be harming competition and consumers.
Precisely. To try and foster more competition.
Okay. So monopolies distort the market, limiting choice, pushing up prices, maybe slowing innovation. What other factors can throw things off?
Another important one to consider is the immobility of resources. Specifically, we often talk about the immobility of labor and capital.
Immobility of resources?
Yeah, think about it.
Yeah.
A well-functioning market kind of relies on resources, workers, machinery, money, being able to move fairly easily to where they are most needed, where they can be used most productively, or where demand is highest.
But that doesn't always happen smoothly, does it?
Not at all. Take labor, for instance. We see geographical immobility.
Yeah.
Workers might be unwilling or just unable to relocate to areas with better job opportunities.
Why is that?
Oh, lots of reasons. Maybe the high cost of housing in the destination city, strong family or community ties they don't want to break. Maybe just a lack of information about opportunities elsewhere, or the costs and hassle of moving itself.
Yeah, I can see that. Moving is a big deal.
Definitely. And then there's occupational immobility. This is where workers lack the necessary skills, training, or qualifications to transition into new industries that are growing, especially if their old industry is shrinking, perhaps due to technological change or globalization.
So the skills don't match the available jobs.
Right. This can lead to situations of structural unemployment, people being out of work long term, even when there are job openings technically available, but in different sectors or requiring different skills. Capital can be immobile, too. Sometimes specialized machinery might not be easily repurposed.
So even if there's a demand for, say, software engineers in one part of the country, or for workers in renewable energy, if people who lost jobs in manufacturing can't physically get there, or don't have the right programming or technical skills, the market struggles to efficiently match that supply of labor with the demand.
Precisely. The market signals higher wages in tech, for example, might be there, but the resources can't respond quickly or easily enough.
Do governments try to help with this?
Yes, often they do. They might try to address these immobility issues through policies like providing better information about job opportunities in different regions, offering relocation assistance, or funding retraining programs to help workers acquire the skills needed for those in-demand sectors.
Makes sense. Trying to grease the wheels of the labor market a bit. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. Externalities, merit-demerit goods and information failure, public goods, monopolies, and immobility of resources. Is there one more key factor our sources highlight?
Yes, one final but quite important contributor to market failure is something called short-termism.
Short-termism. Focusing on the now.
Exactly. It's the tendency for individuals, businesses, and sometimes even governments to prioritize immediate benefits and short-term gains, often at the expense of long-term well-being, sustainability, or future prosperity.
How does focusing just on the short term lead to problems in the market specifically? Isn't the market all about immediate transactions?
Well, yes, but those immediate transactions can have long-term consequences that aren't properly priced in. Think about the example of exploiting natural resources. A company might maximize its quarterly profits by, say, overfishing a certain stock or clear-cutting a forest rapidly.
Right, immediate profit.
But they might not fully consider or be forced to account for the long-term consequences, the depletion of the fish stock for future generations, the soil erosion and loss of biodiversity from deforestation, the contribution to climate change from burning fossil fuels extracted quickly for profit.
Because those costs are far off or borne by others?
Exactly. Or they're difficult to quantify in today's prices. Similarly, a government might be tempted, perhaps due to election cycles, to cut funding for long-term investments like infrastructure maintenance or basic scientific research to show immediate budget savings or fund more visible short-term projects.
Even though neglecting infrastructure or R&D could seriously harm the economy in the long run.
Precisely. This short-sighted focus, driven by immediate incentives, can lead to unsustainable practices and significant negative consequences down the line that the market, focused on those immediate transactions, doesn't adequately address or prevent.
So, by prioritizing today's gains, we can create massive problems for tomorrow that the market, with its focus on present transactions and maybe imperfect information about the future, isn't properly accounting for.
Exactly. It's a failure to properly weigh future costs and benefits.
Okay. That covers the main causes pretty thoroughly. Now that we've explored why markets can fail, let's turn our attention to what can actually be done about it. Our sources outline several ways governments try to intervene and correct these failures.
Right, because recognizing the failure is one thing, fixing it is another challenge entirely.
Right. So how did governments try to step in and nudge things back on track when the market isn't delivering those optimal outcomes we talked about?
Well, one of the primary tools in their toolkit is the use of taxes and subsidies.
Taxes and subsidies. Okay.
When dealing with negative externalities, like that factory pollution example, governments might impose what are known as Pigouvian taxes.
Pigouvian, named after an economist.
Yes, Arthur Pigou. The idea behind these taxes, think of a carbon tax on emissions or higher taxes on cigarettes or alcohol, is to make the producers or consumers of the harmful good internalize the external cost. Basically, make them pay for the damage they cause to society.
So it raises the price, hopefully reducing consumption or production of the bad thing.
Exactly. It aims to align the private cost with the social cost. Plus, it generates revenue that the government can potentially use to mitigate the negative effects, like funding pollution cleanup or public health programs.
Right, making the polluter pay or the smoker pay more towards healthcare costs. Makes sense. And what about the flip side, when we want to encourage something beneficial?
For goods or services that generate those positive externalities we discussed, like vaccinations, education, or maybe research and development, governments often use subsidies.
So financial help.
Exactly. By providing financial support, they can lower the cost for individuals or producers. This makes these beneficial activities more affordable and attractive, encouraging greater consumption or production than the market would provide on its own. Think about government funding for universities, subsidies for renewable energy installation, or tax breaks for R&D spending.
Okay, so taxes to discourage the bad, subsidies to encourage the good, seems logical. What other levers can governments pull?
Another crucial set of tools involves regulation and legislation. This is a really broad category.
Laws and rules.
Yes. It encompasses a wide array of rules and laws designed to directly control harmful activities, protect consumers, ensure safety, and promote fair competition. For example, governments might outright ban the sale of certain dangerous drugs or chemicals. They set environmental regulations to limit pollution levels from factories or cars.
Mm-hmm.
They implement minimum wage laws to provide a floor for worker income or workplace safety standards. And as we mentioned with monopolies, they enforce antitrust laws to prevent companies from abusing market power.
So this is less about changing prices with tax subsidies and more about setting direct ground rules and standards for how the market can operate, trying to steer behavior in a more socially desirable direction.
Precisely. Command and control in some cases. Then there's the option of direct public provision of goods and services.
Okay, the government just doing it itself.
Yeah. As we discussed earlier with public goods like national defense, street lighting, or maybe basic infrastructure like major highways, the free market often struggles to provide these adequately because of the free rider problem.
Right.
In such cases, the government may step in directly to finance through taxes and provide these goods and services itself to ensure that everyone has access. Our sources might also mention examples like publicly run schools, hospitals in some countries, or historically nationalized industries like postal services or utilities, though the trend has often been towards privatization in recent decades.
So the government essentially becomes the provider for things deemed essential, or things the market just can't or won't deliver reliably on its own.
Exactly. And finally, relating back to merit and demerit goods and that information failure, governments often utilize information campaigns.
Trying to educate people.
Yes. Trying to influence consumption patterns by providing better information. By educating the public about the long-term benefits of merit goods, think campaigns promoting healthy eating, the importance of exercise, the advantages of early childhood education, they hope to encourage people to consume more.
Makes sense.
And similarly, they run campaigns highlighting the risks associated with the merit goods, graphic anti-smoking advertisements, public service announcements about the dangers of drunk driving or gambling addiction to try and reduce their use by correcting that information gap.
So trying to tackle that lack of awareness or misperception by giving people clearer information about the true costs and benefits, hoping they'll make different choices.
Exactly. It's about influencing behavior through information rather than just price signals or rules.
Okay, that's a good overview of the main tools. To really solidify our understanding, our sources likely provide some real-world examples of these market failures and the government responses, right?
Yeah, seeing it in practice really helps.
So let's take a look at those. What are some concrete instances where we've seen market failure in action? And how have governments actually tried to intervene?
Okay, well, one prominent example that often comes up is air pollution in major cities.
Right, we touched on that with externality.
Exactly. As our sources probably highlight, the pollution from vehicles, factories, power plants, it generates significant negative externalities. Respiratory problems, asthma, environmental degradation, acid rain. The costs are huge and widespread.
And how have governments responded?
With a whole range of measures, really. Things like implementing stricter emission standards for vehicles and factories, that's regulation. Investing in public transportation infrastructure to offer alternatives to driving, that's public provision and subsidy. And in some places, imposing congestion charges to drive into city centers or carbon taxes on polluting activities, that's using taxes.
So a mix and match approach. That clearly illustrates using regulation, provision, and taxation to tackle those negative externalities from pollution. What's another real-world case?
Another classic example is education, which is widely viewed as a merit good.
With positive externalities, too.
Absolutely. Because individuals might not fully appreciate or be able to afford the investment required for the long-term personal and societal benefits, the market, left entirely alone, might underprovide education, especially for lower-income groups.
So what's the typical government response?
Well, in many, many countries, the response includes offering free or heavily subsidized public education, certainly at the primary and secondary levels, and often providing financial aid, like grants and loans, to make higher education more accessible. It's a massive government undertaking in most developed nations.
Again, a direct intervention, public provision and subsidies to encourage the consumption of a good with significant positive spillovers and overall societal benefits. What's maybe one more case study our sources might touch upon? Something different.
A more complex and perhaps controversial example might be the global financial crisis of 2008.
Ah, right. The big one. How is that seen as market failure?
Well, it's often analyzed as a case of significant market failure within the financial sector. Arguments center on things like information failures, complexity of financial products, misaligned incentives, short-term bonuses, encouraging excessive risk-taking by banks, and the creation of massive systemic risk, a risk that the failure of one institution could bring down the whole system. That systemic risk is a huge negative externality.
So the bank's pursuit of profit created risks for everyone else.
That's a common interpretation. The collapse, or near collapse, had devastating consequences for the global economy, job losses, foreclosures, prolonged recession. In response, governments around the world intervened dramatically through implementing much stricter regulations on the banking industry, like capital requirements, stress tests, creating new oversight bodies, and, controversially, providing massive financial bailouts to prevent a complete meltdown of the financial system.
That really underscores how market failures in one critical sector, like finance, can have incredibly far-reaching and damaging consequences for the entire economy and the scale of government intervention needed in response.
Absolutely. It highlights the interconnectedness and the potential for catastrophic failure. However, it's really essential to remember that government intervention itself isn't always a perfect solution. It's not a magic wand.
Right.
Our sources might also touch on the flip side, the concept of government failure.
government failure. Okay, so when the attempts to fix the market end up making things worse, or maybe just create a whole new set of problems.
Exactly. Just because there's a market failure doesn't automatically mean any government intervention will improve the situation. There are several ways intervention can go wrong.
Like what?
Well, one common issue is unintended consequences. Policies can have ripple effects that weren't foreseen or desired. For example, imposing very high taxes on, say, alcohol or cigarettes might lead to the growth of illegal black markets to avoid the tax.
Undermining the health goal and creating crime.
Potentially, yes. Or regulations might impose heavy compliance costs on businesses, which could stifle innovation or disproportionately affect smaller firms. Minimum wage laws, while intended to help low-income workers, could arguably lead to some job losses, though the extent is heavily debated among economists.
Okay, unintended side effects. Yep. What else?
Another challenge is the sheer complexity and cost of administering large-scale government programs. Public services can sometimes suffer from inefficiencies, lack of flexibility, or bureaucratic hurdles compared to private sector alternatives, although that's not always the case. There are administrative costs to any intervention.
Right, running big government programs isn't easy or cheap.
Definitely not. And finally, there's always the risk of political influence. Policies might end up being shaped more by lobbying efforts from special interest groups or by short-term political calculations rather than by what's truly in the broader long-term public interest. Regulatory capture is a term sometimes used here.
So the intervention might benefit a select few rather than fixing the original market failure effectively for everyone.
That's the concern, yes. So it's a really delicate balancing act. Governments have these tools, taxes, subsidies, regulation, provision, information to address market failures, but those tools need to be designed carefully, implemented effectively, and constantly evaluated, always with a clear understanding of the potential downsides and the risk of government failure itself.
It's definitely not simple.
Not at all. So just to quickly recap the whole thing. Market failure happens when the free market, left to its own devices, doesn't allocate resources efficiently, leading to a loss of overall economic and social well-being. This can stem from various sources we discussed, externalities, those spillover costs or benefits, the unique characteristics of merit and demerit goods often linked with information failure, the nature of public goods leading to the free rider problem, the distorting power of monopolies, the sluggishness or immobility of resources like labor, and that pervasive issue of short-termism.
Right, a whole range of potential problems.
And governments employ a range of interventions to try and correct these failures, using taxes and subsidies to adjust incentives, setting regulations and laws, directly providing certain goods and services, and running information campaigns. But these interventions aren't guaranteed successes and come with their own potential drawbacks and the risk of government failure, unintended consequences, high costs, political influence, and so on.
Thinking about all of this, it really just highlights the incredibly intricate and often contested relationship between the free market and government intervention, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's a constant debate.
So maybe a final thought for everyone listening. Considering the market failures we've talked about, pollution, lack of education or healthcare access, financial instability, monopolies.
Yeah.
What do you think is the most pressing one facing society today? And thinking about those government tools, what kind of intervention do you believe might be most effective? And crucially, why might others disagree with that approach? What are the potential downsides or arguments against it?
Yeah, that's a great question to ponder. There are rarely easy answers.
Definitely something complex to consider as you encounter information about the economy and policy debates out there. Well, thanks for taking this deep dive into the weeds of market failure with us today.
My pleasure. It's a fundamental concept.